These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, Broadcasting Service and NPR affiliates of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, power, empire, and the U.S. elections. Africa World Now Project is next.
You know, it's kind of like we were talking about in the beginning. I don't know.
The current national political climate, as we have been highlighting at least for the past 4 years here on Africa World Now Project, is rooted in the cultural practices of the global imposition of structures and systems born out of specific experiences and communities of people from the geographical landmass called Europe. These historical and contemporary experiences have evolved across time and space, all while these various groups attempted to grapple with their particular and collective inefficiencies through the violent spread of its worldview, the creation of a European modernity, and the proliferation of its institutions that extract the legitimacy and consent of its viability from the peoples and communities it deemed its God-given right to conquer. In short, we are witnessing the entity called Europe, its philosophical and nation-state children attempt to discover a state that it cannot possibly understand on its own. That is a state of peace, equality, and justice. This is because of the thousand-year process to restructure what it means to be human as a justification for the creation and maintenance of private property. The U.S. is a settler state, still trying to reconcile its birth, flirting with arrested notions and a limited imagination that can only understand ideas such as democracy, even its own mythic creation, justice, and citizenship as exclusionary processes. There's no debate about this. We certainly will not debate anyone about this fact. One will either take courage to see the materialization of injustice and inequities and invest their talent into addressing them radically, or continue to be cowardice and turn a blind eye to the deep structural implications of these injustices and inequities, because it takes a weak and cowardice person or group of persons to derive their sense of superiority to the detriment of creating the other. It is a false and porous position at best. The contradictions, its ethos, its worldview, rooted in anti-blackness, anti-indigeneity, anti-nature, anti-human, anti-communal, was and is this nation's Achilles heel. The Achilles heel reference is with layered inference and intended critique. But it must be made clear that no nation is an abstract entity. No institution exists in suspended animation. It is made up of people who carry out its purpose. The institutions of a settler state require sacrifices. It requires the sacrifice of mind, body, and spirit. It requires a non-living entity. But once those non-living entities become living again, the survivability of such institutions and systems must ultimately turn on its keepers. In an article titled "Among the Ruins of Victory," it argues that Donald Trump, a representation of a way of being, was a test run. Worse than him is coming down the road within a decade. Get busy building. Movement activists who supported Biden emphasized that his presidency would give the movement breathing room. Okay, we have maybe 2 years tops to prepare for an even more vicious popular wave of reaction. Today's program will explore the implications as just set out. Next, you will hear Africa World Now Project's Moise Mutale contextualize today's program, which is a recent discussion hosted by the Transnational Institute and the Institute for Policy Studies, where scholars and activists analyzed the global consequences of the recent U.S. elections. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, and Ghana, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
Vous avez lu l'histoire de Jesse James? Comment il a vécu? Comment il est mort? Ça vous a plu, hein? Vous en demandez encore? Eh bien, écoutez l'histoire de Bonnie and Clyde. Alors voilà, Clyde a une petite amie. Elle est belle et son prénom c'est...
Bonnie.
À eux deux, ils forment le gang Barrow. Leur nom...
Bonnie Parker.
Et Clyde Barrow.
Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde.
I'm swimming in light like Mahoney in Cocoon. The truth like bones of man.
Welcome to Sharmuiza Muntali. On November 3rd, citizens in the U.S. went to the polls for the 59th time to elect a president. With the backdrop of the global novel coronavirus pandemic, the Black Lives Matter movement, economic crisis, this election had the highest turnout since 1900, and the winner and loser received more votes than ever before. After 4 days on November 7th, all major media networks in the country declared Joe Biden as the winner, beating the incumbent Donald Trump, who has yet to concede defeat. Today, the show features a portion of a discussion presented recently by the Transnational Institute, TNI, and the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, entitled Power, Empire, and U.S. Elections, Internationalist Perspectives. The conversation highlighted issues concerning global politics and global governance, U.S. militarism, and challenges and opportunities for campaigns committed to social and environmental justice. The conversation featured Phyllis Bennis of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, and is also author of Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. Walden Bellow, Transnational Institute Associate and author of Paper Dragons, China and the Next Crash, and Capitalism's Last Stand? Deglobalization in the Age of Austerity. Kathy Feingold, Director of AFL-CIO's International Department, Deputy President of the International Trade Union Confederation, and Bill Fletcher Jr., Executive Editor of GlobalAfricanWorker.com, past President of TransAfrica Forum, and a longtime writer and trade unionist. The moderator is Laura Flanders, journalist and host of the Laura Flanders Show. First, you'll hear the moderator, Laura Flanders, who'll be followed by Phyllis Bennis and Walden Bellow.
Good morning, afternoon, evening, all of the rest. I'm Laura Flanders, and I host a show called The Laura Flanders Show. The Laura Flanders Show can be seen every week on public television in the U.S., also on public radio, and is available on YouTube or at the lauraflanders.org website. It's a forward-looking kind of a show that I think you would all enjoy, so I encourage you to check it out. This webinar that you have signed up for, that you are joining us in, is on power, empire, and U.S. politics. We're going to be taking an international look, an internationalist look, at election 2020 in the U.S. It's part of TNI's Ideas into Movement webinar series. These webinars seek to provide an internationalist perspective on key moments and issues. For those who don't know, the Transnational Institute, based in Amsterdam, it's an international activist think and do tank, I like to say. It's committed to transformative change and social justice. The webinar today was co-organized with TNI's sister organization in the United States, the Institute for Policy Studies, familiarly known as IPS. IPS is a progressive think tank about which you're going to hear a whole lot more. So where are we? Let's start with just a little bit of setting the scene. The world woke up on Sunday to the dying days of the Trump administration, we think. On Saturday night, all the major television networks in the US called the 2020 presidential race for Joe Biden and his running mate, Kamala Harris. After the highest turnout election in over a century, there was celebration in the streets across the U.S., and calls from foreign leaders to Biden started coming in. According to the Guardian newspaper, President Ibrahim Mohamed Saleh of the Maldives was the first to call, presumably to remind Joe Biden of the urgency of addressing climate change and the waters rising on the Maldives shores. But while there has been a victory, there has not been a concession. But both Joe Biden and Donald Trump scored record-breaking vote totals, some 75 million and 70 million votes apiece. Donald Trump has not given up yet. More importantly, perhaps there's been no conceding from Trump or his party that there was anything problematic with their pursuit of America first nationalism abroad or white ethno-nationalism and proud patriarchy at home. And there's been no renunciation yet of their go-it-alone, profits-first approach to addressing a global pandemic. On the Democratic side, with Trump maybe on his way, the tensions within what was always a very fragile left-right coalition are at a breaking point. After months of effort and millions of dollars spent, the dreamed-of blue tsunami didn't materialize. Looking to January, we are still going to have very bitterly divided government. And just as a reminder, in the U.S. system, the president can do a lot through executive order, and Donald Trump certainly showed how it can be done. He can do a lot through appointments, but the Biden team will be walking, when they walk into Washington, into a very demoralized and hollowed out civil service. Crises loom on every front, from a recession to a racial reckoning to a cold winter of COVID. Legislation requires Congress and its majorities in two requires Congress and majorities in two houses. In the lower house, the Democratic majority still holds, but it's smaller. In the Senate, two Georgia seats remain undecided, but whatever the outcome there, power will be very narrowly split. For internationalists today, namely us, considering power, empire, and US politics in the global context, history could keep us up at night. Nothing unites US parties and the major media here like action abroad, be it tariffs on China, say, or coup plots against Latin American leftists, or anti-terror arms sales in the names of fighting terror, to Israel or Saudi Arabia. The Biden foreign policy team is likely to be full of names you know from the Obama years. So what does it all add up to? Much more is needed to be said about international solidarity, and that's part of what the conversation is about here today. Connection and relationship building across borders between individuals, organizations, and their institutions are all important. So that's why I'm excited to present this panel of some of the leading thinkers and activists who have long challenged US foreign policy, working with social movements against the war in Afghanistan and Iraq for fair trade and in support of worker rights. Phyllis Bennis, I think you are well placed to talk to both the tenseness here in the US at this moment, being that you're based there in Washington, but also the sense of, I want to say possibility, maybe probability. I don't know whether you're more in fear or in hope at this moment. But we're thinking about the questions of whether what we look at next is a continuation, a real rupture, or a return. What are you looking at, Phyllis?
I think that we are all here in the US, not all, but half of us are very, very relieved after the calling of the election against Trump. The rejoicing in the streets, in my view, was very much a focus on being an end of the Trump era, significantly more than it was a celebration of Biden. But we do have to be very careful. This election consequence is not clear yet. It's not over yet. But assuming that we will go forward with a post-Trump agenda, we do have to recognize that this election that did repudiate Trump did not repudiate Trumpism. And on the international front, that means that it did not repudiate international provocations, militarism, unilateralism, opposition to diplomacy, absolute global corruption, support for global dictatorships, all of these things. It was not a full repudiation of that. So we start with that reality in the context of US imperialism itself in a decline, but yet still being the most powerful empire, indeed, that the world has ever seen, the most wealthy, the strongest militarily, despite new challenges on both of those fronts, from China and from others. But it remains the most powerful single actor right now in the world. And we have to take that into account as we look to, towards what will come ahead. If we look to what the Biden agenda might look like, this notion of, is it about rupture or continuation or return? I think that we will see a large amount of return to the Obama agenda on issues of trade, on the global war on terror, but also some of the things that we will see returning after being destroyed largely by Trump, which include multilateralism and the role at the UN, human rights, despite the legacy of hypocrisy of how the US has dealt with multilateralism, the UN, human rights. Having it on the official agenda was a very important tool for social movements here and globally to challenge those violations of human rights, those false claims of multilateralism, that sort of thing. What the key shift that we're dealing with in terms of what are the conditions that we face in what is Biden's foreign policy going to look like is that, as Laura mentioned, there has been a real shift in the Democratic Party. The left is not the most dominant force right now in the party, but the left wing of the party, what some call the Bernie Sanders wing, the Elizabeth Warren wing, that wing of the party is both ascendant and more powerful than it has been in generations, in decades. And in that context, I think that there is a much greater option for changing, for pressure to work on the Democratic Party, because the reason that the Democratic Party and the Biden administration really squeaked by in this election, we have to be clear, they won the popular vote by several million, that's true, in the context of 150 million or so electorate, that's not a big divide. It was, in fact, a very close election. And we have to be very sober in looking at what that means. In terms of the actual agenda, I think that we will see some changes, but not enough. And we're going to have to fight for every one of those changes that we are able to see. The wars are going to look very much like Obama's wars, not like George Bush's wars, meaning that the reliance on massive numbers of ground troops and full occupation of countries will probably not be the common thing that we see in the next period. We will see a complete continuation of the focus on drone wars and airstrikes and special forces, special operations in countries throughout, particularly the greater Middle East, North Africa region, but in a number of places around the world, and increasing reliance on that kind of militarism. In Iran, we will see, I think, a return of the Biden administration return to the Iran nuclear deal, which, of course, Trump had with great fanfare pulled out of the nuclear deal. There will be an effort for, and Biden, in fact, has already committed to this, to go back to the deal. It's not at all clear what additional concessions the Iranians may demand as a result of the terrible impact of 4 years of crippling sanctions that the U.S. imposed on the people of Iran. There will be a price to pay for that if the U.S. is serious about wanting to go back. But I think there will be a return to diplomacy in the Iranian theater. The one place I think we'll see the biggest rupture will be on Yemen. I think that, assuming that our movements are strong enough, I think that we will see the possibility of a real end to U.S. support for the war in Yemen. That doesn't mean that U.S. responsibility for that war, which has been, as we know, the United Nations has identified it as the worst humanitarian disaster in the world, the numbers of civilian casualties, particularly in the era of COVID, I think that we will see pressure, and we'll see whether it will be enough to force the United States to take some responsibility for the disaster that it has helped bring there, as it has in Afghanistan and Iraq. And then finally, on the question of the global pandemic, I think we will see a rupture with the Trump position. We will see a rejoining of the WHO, whether that includes joining COVAX, the international WHO-led coalition to make sure that any vaccines that are produced are made available globally on an equitable basis. That means challenging the big pharmaceutical companies in the United States. Whether the Biden administration is prepared to take that on, a big question right now. We have no idea. And if there's any move towards that, we are going to need a massive level of mobilization, popular mobilization in the United States, to demand that that must be part of the U.S. policy on dealing with COVID, both domestically and globally. So we're in for a very long struggle, I think. We're going to have to fight very, very hard. The protests against what are likely to be the appointments in things like the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, they are not going to be people that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party support, let alone people that we would support. And those protests, I think, are going to have to start on day one after the inauguration. Mm. Thank you.
Thanks, Phyllis. Walden, to you, I want to take every opportunity to remind people that Naomi Klein has called you the world's leading no-nonsense revolutionary, and I think we're going to hear no-nonsense from you now. I haven't actually heard whether the Philippines President Duterte has called Biden, but I suspect he hasn't. He's certainly lost a friend in Trump. But one question I do have for you is the reaction in your part of the world and your sense of what will be the implications for the kind of authoritarian leadership that has not been unelected in this administration, even if Trump has been given a humbling to a degree. They haven't. And many are drawing from the tightness of the election, in fact, some comfort that Trumpism did pretty darn well.
Okay, thank you very much, Laura. And it's great to see all of you. And thanks to TNI and IPS for sponsoring, you know, this dialogue that we're having today. First of all, Laura, President Duterte did congratulate Biden. Okay, this was about 2 days ago. And he, you know, I think that his threat to withdraw the Philippines from the visiting forces agreement with the United States that he made a few months ago, then he backed away from that. I think that he is going to keep the United States, that agreement with the United States. Of course, to our great disappointment, because I personally had felt that Duterte would, in fact, move to cancel that agreement. So I think generally I would say that in this part of the world, that there was also a sigh of relief when Biden came out as winning the elections. What does it mean? Well, one of the things we've got to remember is that the moves to define China as the strategic competitor of the United States, it was initially made by George Bush back in 2001, 2002, but that was subordinated to Bush's effort to win China in the global war against terror, bring China in there as an ally. And it was really under the Obama move to really act towards China as the strategic competitor of the United States. And if we remember, it was President Obama back around 2011-2012 that initiated what he called the Pacific Pivot, which was the redeployment of the majority or the bulk of U.S. naval power to the Pacific. And the aim was quite clearly to contain China militarily. I think that the deterioration in terms of the political and economic relations between China and the United States did not start with Trump. Okay, accelerated with Obama, and of course Trump brought it to a really new level. So what would we expect here? I think that looking at the statements of Biden and Biden's people, I think they are worried about China's industrial policy. They're worried about Chinese technological advances. They're worried about what they would see as China's violations of intellectual property rights, much like maybe not as extremely as Peter Navarro, but certainly that same concern about China's type of economic industrial model bugs key Democrats and economic specialists. And in some of his statements, in fact, Biden has already referred to that. Okay. My sense is that Biden is not going to push on with a trade war. But I think on this front of challenging China in industrial policy, technology, intellectual property rights, I think that that will continue. And much of Peter Navarro's agenda will be carried on, although maybe not in as crude a fashion as Navarro. I think, though, that one thing that we should be expecting is the Biden administration will, especially when it comes to differentiating itself from the Trump administration, take on the banner of human rights when it comes to China, and use that as a sort of a soft power kind of stick. And I think that over on that, I think we can expect that there will be more and more appeals to that when it comes to dealing with China, with with Beijing, reacting in kind. Mm-hmm. That will also come up when it comes to Hong Kong. Then I think that one area where I think there was generally a positive moves on the part of Trump was Korea. Okay, let's face it. Korea. Trump did contribute to ending the Cold War in the Korean Peninsula. Okay. And the kind of very tense hot war, Cold War that existed, before Trump, that I think has been significantly reduced. Okay, mm-hmm. And now whatever his motivations were, I think that in this area, I think that it was a plus in the Korean Peninsula.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah. One last thing, though, that I would like to say is there has been basically, you know, what has been really the basic continuity of U.S. policy in the Asia Pacific has been provided by the military, the U.S. military. There's been a continuation from Bush to Obama to Trump, and I expect that that kind of continuity will keep up with Biden. Now, this is what I worry about because the military posture towards China has become more and more aggressive over the years. And the one thing that I would just like to say at this point is that the operative doctrine, military doctrine of the United States, is called air-sea battle, and that its conceptual foe is very clearly China. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. 7th Fleet is out there in the South China Sea with a lot of very dueling kind of moves with China. And I think that this kind of provocative interactions with China, especially on the naval front, is going to continue under Biden.
So I'm hearing soft power with warships and a dangerous level of continuity.
And that was Laura Flanders, who's a journalist and host of the Laura Flanders Show. And she was a moderator at a recent conversation presented by the Transnational Institute and the Institute for Policy Studies entitled Power, Empire, and U.S. Elections, Internationalist Perspectives. Earlier on, you heard Phyllis Bennis of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies and Walden Bellow, Transnational Institute associate and author and activist. We're playing a portion of that discussion, which was presented by TNI and IPS, as we reflect on the U.S. elections and beyond. We're going to go back to the show. Now you'll hear Kathy Feingold, director of the AFL-CIO's International Department, deputy president of the International Trade Union Confederation, and Bill Fletcher Jr., executive editor of GlobalAfricanWorker.com, and a past president of TransAfrica Forum and a longtime writer and trade unionist. The moderator is Laura Flanders, journalist and host of The Laura Flanders Show. Again, we're featuring a portion of a discussion presented recently by the Transnational Institute, TNI, and the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, entitled Power, Empire, and the U.S. Elections, Internationalist Perspectives.
Bill Fletcher, I want to come to you as former president of the Trans-Africa Forum, among other things, and I mentioned executive editor of GlobalAfricanWorker.com. I got to ask you to talk about what we're hearing about famine in Yemen, Burkina Faso, Nigeria, South Sudan, the COVID crisis, of course. None of this got much discussion on the campaign. The continent of Africa was barely mentioned during the campaign. We're likely to hear from Joe Biden that he will rejoin the WHO, but that in and of itself is not that's not a solution to the crisis that continent faces. I'd love your take and also your sense of how U.S. foreign policy gets taken up within the United States now after an election that touched on it so little.
Well, thank you, Laura. And let me respond to that. I want to make three points in general, but I want to respond specifically to what you're raising, and perhaps it will come up later in the discussion. When you're living at the heart of the empire, it's very easy for people to deny the importance of international affairs. National chauvinism is very much alive and well in the United States. And so it's very easy, and we see it election after election, where very, very important international issues are basically brushed aside as secondary to our various domestic concerns. And the absence of a strong constituency in the United States that practices genuine solidarity further complicates the matter. 3 points about the elections overall. One is that these elections were about racism, revanchism, and the rejection of reality. And the Trump forces and the articulation over the last 4 years around domestic and global racism have been absolutely phenomenal in that opening up all sorts of doors that many people thought had been closed, and appealing to this fear among large numbers of whites of a changing demographic, you know, what they call white replacement or white genocide. The issue of revanchism is a catch-all for the entire politics of revenge and the assertion that something was taken from somebody that they want back. And we see this playing out at the level of gender, foreign policy, and this whole notion of let us return to a more comfortable era like the 1950s. And the third thing is this rejection of reality, that we had 70 million people that voted for someone who denied the importance, the reality of the COVID pandemic and denied the reality of climate disaster. People were doing that. We should stop excusing it. People were explicitly voting for that. And we've got to deal with that. That's part of our political reality. Second thing is, yes, this is the election results, as you point out, indicate how divided the United States is. But I think we should understand historically, the United States has been very divided since its inception. And you look at election after election, and every so often there's, you know, a huge gap. But it's very frequent that there's not a huge gap. The 1960 election, for example, between Kennedy and Nixon was settled with Kennedy having, I think, maybe 1% of the popular vote over Nixon. One of the things that's different, however, is that when Republicans win close elections, they claim a mandate. When Democrats win close elections, they second guess themselves. They do, rah, 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 you know, this is terrible. We didn't do well enough. And then they just sink into a funk. Trump lost the popular vote in 2016, but he and his minions walked away claiming a mandate. So we have to understand the propaganda of this. The third point is that the issue of global revanchism versus global internationalism or global multilateralism in terms of identifying Trump and versus Biden. So Trump's politics globally, to the extent that there was any coherence, were revanchist and a peculiar form of isolationism. And I think that people often don't get that when we talk about isolationism in the United States, we're not really talking about isolationism. There never really has been an isolationist movement in the United States where people said, shut us off from the rest of the world. U.S. isolationism means something very specific. It means we do not want to be encumbered by agreements. We want to be able to do whatever the hell we want to do whenever we can. So even when you look at the 1930s, the so-called isolationist movement was basically softcore fascist. It basically did not want to intervene in Europe, but it never said, let's pull out of Latin America. Let's stop mucking around with Asia. And so Trump is very consistent with that. I think that what we're going to see with Biden, as has been pointed out, is much more a return to sort of the capitalist multilateralism. The Biden serving as the chair of the board of global capital. And in the interest of time, let me just say one thing about the issue of China that I think we have to consider. There really is a kind of a contradiction. And it existed, it's existed for a while. It was existing under the Obama administration, but also under Trump. And I think we'll see it with Biden, and this contradiction between the interest of the transnational capitalist class and its ties within China and the interests of certain state sectors in the United States, particularly the issue of the military, and the role that China plays as a propaganda piece for the right wing. And so I think we have to understand how incredibly complicated this overall situation is. In the interest of time, Laura, let me just stop there.
We would love just one or two words on the question of Africa, though. I mean, this continent facing, I mean, I think it's the UN now saying famine virtually guaranteed. Yemen, Burkina Faso, Nigeria, South Sudan. You've got a looming civil war in Ethiopia. Just you think you have a minute. You have a minute
okay.
to give on that?
So Trump didn't give a damn about Africa. So that's the easy part of the answer. Now, the issue of Biden is, I think, Laura, it's going to depend on whether there really is sufficient pressure on Biden from a pro-Africa world constituency. Because I'm sure that there will be certain kinds of uptick in humanitarian assistance. I'm sure something like that's going to happen. But will the Biden administration, for example, deploy an envoy to help to try to mediate the conflict in Ethiopia? I don't know. Back in the Obama, when Obama was in the Senate, he authored some legislation around the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where he was calling for a special envoy and for particular kinds of assistance to try to remedy the conflict. Whether the Biden administration will go forward with these kind of measures, I'm not going to be cynical. I'm going to say it really depends on us. I think that the default position for most U.S. administrations post-Cold War is that Africa is largely irrelevant except from the standpoint of natural resources. That will only change if we raise hell.
All right. Well, that's not cynical. That's exactly on message for this webinar. So thank you, Bill, for that. But I'm very interested in hearing now from Kathy Feingold. She's the AFL-CIO International Director and Deputy President of the International Trade Union Confederation. For those that don't know, that is a global body representing 200 million union workers around the globe. She has more than 20 years of experience in trade and global economic policy. And in 2020, Speaker Pelosi appointed Feingold to the Independent Mexico Labor Expert Board, the body created under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the agreement that was supposed to monitor and evaluate labor reforms and worker right compliance in Mexico. There's so much to talk to you about, Kathy, but obviously perhaps our audience today could do with just a little primer on how embedded in the global capital universe this incoming administration of Biden-Harris is, and in particular, perhaps in the IT and tech universe, Kamala Harris, hailed as a history breaker in so many ways, first woman of color, child of immigrants, South Asian, you name it, but very heavily embedded in Silicon Valley. And we saw a very important ballot initiative go down to defeat this election that would really have secured some rights for so-called gig workers in the drive share economy, went down to massive defeat. Millions of dollars spent, and some of the public faces of the Uber side and Lyft side, the corporate side, fighting for the defeat of this initiative, were very tightly tied to the Democratic establishment, even to Harris's own family, her brother-in-law, and to the former Obama administration in the form of Valerie Jarrett, who sits on the board of Lyft. So in terms of the future challenges of the future workforce, US-wise and global-wise, over to you.
Thanks so much, Laura, and thanks to IPS and TNI. It's great to be with everybody. And Laura, you jump right into some of the big challenges. But let me just say, I think as others have already stated, you know, this election is situated in a whole set of crises that already existed, right? Pandemic, economic inequality. Laura, you're already talking about, we already had enormous economic inequality policies that were already, pre-Trump administration that were already very anti-worker, racial inequality, climate, attacks on democratic institutions. And we've actually seen movements meeting and calling for systemic change. So I actually start from a place of, it's the movements that give me hope. It's the movements that organized in this election and the movements that are going to make the change happen, not necessarily in an administration. We're going to need movements holding this administration, every step of the way, to make sure that we have a policy that works for working people and for the climate. And I actually think we have an opportunity like we haven't seen before to really align, because of these movements, domestic demands around anti-militarization, addressing racial inequality, economic inequality, with our foreign policy. Traditionally we have domestic policy over here and global is some other kind of policy, but I think we need to be looking at what are the demands we're seeing made here in the U.S. And how do those play out globally? So we need to challenge, I think, whether it's the Make America Great Again framework. Let's remember, we've always had American exceptionalism framework. We've had many frameworks that have been problematic globally, and we need to challenge those. And I think, again, this crisis makes it that we really need to build something new. How can we be exceptional in the face of a health pandemic and the climate crisis? We all need to be in this together. So we're really in this moment of needing to build a new framework for global policy. I think the president-elect in various articles has laid out, we need to reclaim our seat at the table. We need to continue to write the rules. And I have to say, this gives me pause. Because to your point, Laura, the rules that have been written to date, whether it was under the Trump administration or previous Democratic administrations, have been precisely pro-corporate and not pro-worker. And so I think a big challenge that we are going to have, and you mentioned Silicon Valley, and I can talk about Proposition 22 that people aren't familiar with, which was about platform economy workers, is how do we, as movements, as unions, get to the table to make sure that we are reshaping rules. We're not going back to some old normal where there was this incredible imbalance between workers and capital. So one is whatever table we're going back to, we need movements, we need unions at the table to shape those policy. The second is the notion that we are just going to go back to multilateralism, to this global architecture that was just fine before, 4 years ago. Let's be clear, we have a global architecture that's not fit for purpose. And we keep, those of us, I feel like, the challenges we have in the global labor movement is we both engage the multilateral system, and at the same time, we need to be thinking about how to transform it. It is, a system that has these rules ingrained in them that are, pro-corporate, not very much around the vision that the U.S. has. That's a racialized vision of foreign policy, of how our supply chains, how we're opening up markets. And so I think one big task we have is, what is our vision for a new global architecture? What is a multilateral system that would work for working people? And I think, this is the moment to be doing it. We don't know what the new normal is. We're not going backwards. We know it didn't work before. And I think all of us are here to figure out, what is it? What are the rules that we need to put forward? We're good at critiquing. I think that, Biden has said, as a nation, we have to prove that we're ready to lead again. And again, this gives me a little bit of pause. He says, with the example of our power, but also with the power of our example. But this is, then this means if our example to the rest of the world needs to be, how do we rethink military budgets or police budgets, which are the demands here in the United States from the Black Lives Matter movement? How do we stop militarizing community of color here and globally? How do we stop militarizing our borders and address immigration from a very different framework? How do we actually welcome asylum-seeking families? So I think, the vision that we're hearing from the Biden administration is one that probably is comfortable to folks from from the Obama administration, but I would say we're in a very different moment, and we are going to need to be challenging this framework of what power should look like. A couple other thoughts on, I think, a proactive agenda, and then I know we're going to open it up here. One is, I think Biden's promise on these executive orders is really important. Paris Agreement, the WHO, the Muslim ban being overturned, the military ban on transgender, and the Dreamers program. That's a good start. But that is just bringing us back to, where we were 4 years ago. And we need to, really move forward in a different way. So the economic model, we are in a critical moment where you have everyone from the Financial Times editorial board to the Pope agreeing that the neoliberal model of the past four decades has not worked. So we need to take advantage of this moment. How do we make sure that when economic policy, when the rebuilding that's going to have to happen post-pandemic happens where governments are in a room negotiating not on behalf of corporations, but on behalf of the needs of workers and of people and of the environment? That's something we need to be doing right now. If we're going to rebuild with resilience, we're going to need to rebuild in a way that recognizes resilience means social protection for workers, a new social contract for workers. Two other points. One, I would say trade policy. That's one that we hotly debate in the United States, but it really needs to be part of this broader rules-based economy that we need to reshape. The U.S. has supported, a system that's elevated capital over labor for years and years. And we're always in a situation of tweaking bad neoliberal models. We need to put forward a new model. It is, it's high time that we transition and get a new model. So I see, Laura, that my time is coming to an end.
Well, I have just one follow-up question, and then I'll give you a chance to end probably, but I have to take a moment to plug an upcoming episode of the Laura Flanders Show, which is talking exactly about these questions. And we have a little interview with Mary Kay Henry, the president of the SEIU, right now on our podcast stream. So I urge people, she's talking exactly about this question of the new normal. If you go to lauraflanders.org/listen, you'll find it. But the question or two questions that she raises, one is, how do you accomplish anything like a new normal when we have as much division as we do in Washington? But the second question that I have for you, Kathy, is a follow-up, just because so few people really understand the relationship that you sit at the nexus of internationalism and U.S. labor. We just saw an election in which, if the exit polls are correct, 40% of union households voted for Trump. To what extent is there discussion within the international body that you represent of a reaction to that? I guess I'm wondering, is there help coming from other countries to our labor movement?
So absolutely, and I know we're going to talk, we have heard from around the world about this current moment. So yes, we're getting support and solidarity because civil society is being attacked. Unions are being attacked. Democracy is being attacked around the world. We're hearing from our brothers and sisters in the Belarus independent unions, Zimbabwe. They all have inspired us about the pushbacks we've had to do here around democracy. But let me just answer your other question, Laura, because I know we'll have a few more moments on the social movement piece. There are issues that bring people together. And I think that I'm sure Mary Kay probably, Henry of SEIU probably echoed some of this about contract. Imagine if we asked about policies, trade policy, global economic policy, how we support supply chains in other countries. If we asked the simple question, does it contribute to the well-being of working people and does it protect the environment? What if we centered things by asking those questions and policies in a different way? If we had a different light, by which instead of is it, shareholder profits being maximized and supply chain, or the flexibility, if we had a whole different set of questions. The other thing I think is if you argue for this moment, both in the US and globally, that workers, we need a different relationship between labor and capital. You need a new social contract. You need to rebalance that. Health and safety protections, I don't think anyone's going to argue against. Living minimum wages. I think there's a whole basic fundamental rights to organize, to speak your mind, so that you're safe when you do it. I think there's a whole foundation that we can build that actually can bridge a divide, that can build more power for working people across divides. I know it's going to be a bumpy road ahead. Absolutely. Our movement does a lot of internal debates about this. But I do think that there is a place that we can build domestic and global visioning that really is about building more power for working people, protecting the environment, and building back better and more transformative economy. Thanks.
Beautiful. Thank you, Kathy. Appreciate it.
That was Kathy Fangold, Director of AFL-CIO's International Department, Deputy President of the International Trade Union Confederation, and Bill Fletcher Jr., Executive Editor of GlobalAfricanWorker.com, a past president of TransAfrica Forum, and a longtime writer and trade unionist. The moderator was Laura Flanders, journalist and host of The Laura Flanders Show. They were featured in a discussion presented recently by the Transnational Institute, TNI, and the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, entitled Power, Empire, and U.S. Elections, Internationalist Perspectives. The other panelists included Phyllis Bennis of New Internationalism Project at Institute for Policy Studies and author of Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power, and Walden Bellow, Transnational Institute Associate and author of Paper Dragons, China and the Next Crash.
To the team. Myself to see if I could feel. Then I began to pray to see if God was real. I said, all see and reveal to me that which is concealed. Something told me that I probably shouldn't be behind the wheel of that Bonneville. I was still feeling kinda ill, not a dollar bill. Time to kill, trying to sign a deal. 10 years before State Prop was rock La Famille. I was popping pills, unaware that still sharp and still I'm grown. Dropping my popular B-boy poems. Took me to a Mary Baraka from Leroy Jones, to Haj Malik El Shabazz from Detroit Red, and to the Paula. Opposite of what your report said, with me and Spinal was playing our part.
That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Mutale, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funda Ngunda, senior research, content contributor, and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior researcher and content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, technology advisor is Byron Gray of GrayWorks Technology, and creative director is Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project is heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcasting service of Winston-Salem State University. Shows are archived weekly on SoundCloud. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.
Got the bop gun loaded up to kill one. Drop cruising like Top Gun through Brazil. When your net worth is millions, people too familiar. My network is real young. Careful where you chill, son. I'm the magnificent. Stay playing with them bad bitches. Dilla Slum Village, Mac Nicholas. People know my style, nasty as black licorice. Telephone stack sickening. That's rich. Don't make me burn your wings off like the Icarus. The Lord take away the same thing he giveth us. Temptation, do not lead. Please deliver. Us. When you a beast, you kinda cease to give a fuck. You stop listening. Please tell me not this again. Beg and bring back Black, the block missing him. To murder tracks right in front of mad witnesses. 44 magnificent, what the business is.
I am the most magnificent.
I'm the magnificent.